You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on June 15th, 2014 from Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Persephone and Sarah join me to talk about California's ruling on teacher tenure. Then, Nate joins me to talk about the current crisis in Iraq. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Belgium is Persephone. Persephone, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Bill.
And joining me on the line from Idaho is Sarah. Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay, so we're going to be talking a little bit about education this week. Obviously, education reform, and particularly urban education reform, seems to be an extremely popular topic among fellow millennials, and everyone seems to have done some amount of research or have opinions on it. So I figured we'd talk a little bit about that today, specifically in light of a story from California. The New York Times reported June 10th that there was a ruling. This was not a federal decision, just a state-level decision by a local judge there, but I guess it affects the whole state, potentially. He ruled that teacher tenure laws deprive students of their right to an education under the state constitution and violate their civil rights. Basically, that the teachers' unions were going to have to break all of their tenure agreements with the various districts across the state because this was, in his mind, unconstitutional. This lawsuit was brought by children. But obviously, children don't magically come up with lawsuits. So important to note that this was bankrolled by a bunch of Silicon Valley millionaires and such who already have problems with the education system and particularly with the teachers' unions. So this is a bit of a Trojan horse, potentially, for a general anti-union approach. But that's the general situation. So Persephone, you said there was an op-ed follow-up on this topic. Why don't we start with you to go into that?
Yeah, so in a recent New York Times op-ed, responding to the article that the New York Times published, Jesse Rothstein takes on why it's a problem. Taking on teacher tenure backfires is the title of the piece. And basically, he says that there's a problem here in that the issue here is being misidentified because the judge is using these arguments that this is about equal opportunity and things like that. But the real problem here is underfunding of schools. So the issue here is not that teachers are getting tenure. The issue here is that not all schools are equally funded.
Right, because the claim that was made in the decision was that the reason that this is unconstitutional is that it disproportionately allows teachers, bad teachers, to remain in positions in low-income and minority school districts, and that the bad teachers were kind of being shunted off into those districts and then were unfireable, allegedly. This was what the suit was saying, and this is what he ruled in his opinion. Sarah, you wanted to talk a little bit about the specific problem of quote-unquote bad teachers or underqualified teachers, which is a problem especially in California, being sent into these lower-income districts, because that aspect is a real problem, but is not necessarily a problem for the reasons that are being identified here.
Right. My background is I know I did a position paper about Teach for America, and, you know, despite the Teach for America literature, well, their premise is that subject knowledge is all you really need to be able to transmit that subject knowledge to students, discrediting the art of teaching that any educator would tell you. It is an art, it's a science, it should be research-based, and that's why there are education programs and credential programs and things like that. So one thing that California allows is unqualified, uncredentialed teachers into classrooms, and Teach for America specifically sends their recruits, or however they put it, into rural districts, into poor inner city districts, places where good teachers are hard to find and they're hard to retain. But my issue is that these teachers aren't going to be able to hit the ground running. A lot of them don't know how to formulate lesson plans, for one. They don't know how to be organized and educate in an organized fashion. So, you know, these kids are starting out in their subjects below grade level. And while some Teach for America teachers are good at teaching, maybe it comes naturally to them, really it's underserving these children, and so they can fall even further behind. And then there are conflicting studies that say it doesn't affect test scores any worse than other rookie teachers that have their teaching certification, but other studies show the opposite results. So it's really hard to say, but I would err on the side of trying to make sure qualified, credentialed teachers teach these at-risk groups.
Right. I mean, I think as you said, that well, said and partly implied, this is a program, the Teach for America is a program that is perhaps well-intentioned, but is completely the wrong approach to solving the problem that it seeks to solve. I think that what we're saying here is that rather than sending people with no teaching specific or educational training or experience in to teach these things just because they have some knowledge of the subject, that it would be a lot better to focus on paying teachers more and improving teacher retention, finding ways to keep actually qualified teachers engaged and well compensated and interested in pursuing this, because that way you actually have quality teaching going into these districts rather than just trying to sort of shove in these people who haven't. I mean, they're probably have the best of intentions if they join Teach for America, but it's not necessarily what's best for the student. And it seems like a way of avoiding this sort of central problem in all of American education, which is a lack of respect for the teaching profession and the amount of skill and training required to do it well, as well as what compensation level would be necessary to attract the talent that you want. Because in every other field, you know, non-governmental private sector field, the idea that you would not pay more money to attract better talent is just, that would be so far out of the frame of reference of most business people. I mean, obviously they want to minimize costs, but if they want to get the quote unquote best people, they're not sitting there going, oh, well, what if we just pay them less? Or what if we give them fewer benefits? Or what if we make it easier to fire them and things like that? That's not the approach. It's all about incentives. What kind of incentives can we add to make these people more likely to start in the first place, more likely to stay, help them pay for their cost of getting that education and training on how to be an educator. But as you said, there's this huge problem in California of making it really easy to put these unqualified folks in who have not passed their credential exams, and that seems to be a pretty prevalent problem. One of our readers reacting to this article noted, and she's from California, had noted that the likely outcome of this decision is that the poorer inner city or poorer rural districts are, instead of getting rid of the good teachers, they're going to use this to get rid of the people who have been there for a really long time and are good, because, you know, the tenure system helps protect the last in, first out system, which is not necessarily the greatest system, but at least you don't get rid of the people who have been there for a really long time and are good just because they're expensive. And she said, you know, what's going to happen here is they're going to fill budget gaps by keeping all the new teachers who get paid less because they're new, and then you're going to get rid of all the good experienced teachers, as well as maybe the small number of quote-unquote bad teachers who've been kept around through tenure rules. So that's not necessarily the best solution here. Persephone, I wanted to get back to you again to kind of go a little bit more into this angle about valuing teachers and education and things like that. It seems to be part of a broader trend, especially recently, this focus on trying to bust the teachers' unions rather than strengthening the position of teachers.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that, again, ties back into, you know, the issues with Teach for America, which has also been criticized for undermining unions. But I think it's really part of a larger problem that is, you know, we have these budgeting problems, and, you know, not enough money is going towards education, and all these schools are underfunded. And rather than looking at the best way to use what unfortunately little money there is. And rather than looking at plans from a political perspective, rather than politicians saying, wait a second, education is important, we should be investing more money in this. Instead, what's happening is people are taking it out on teachers. So teachers are getting this kind of double effect of, first of all, any poor results, which are really the result of underfunding, gets blamed on teachers. You know, if kids aren't performing well, they don't think about the fact that maybe these kids aren't, they don't have good textbooks. They don't think about the fact that some of these kids might not have good support within the school. They might not have assistance and they might need assistance. Instead, they're putting all the blame on the teachers. And then that gets used as a justification for cutting costs by cutting teachers. So all these really anti-union measures are all about shifting the blame onto teachers, and they actually decrease the educational outputs. And the thing about tenure is, for all these arguments about, you know, good teachers and bad teachers, I'm sure we all have some teacher that we really didn't like in high school or elementary school or whatever. But the thing is that what we don't think about is the good teachers that need tenure to engage in, you know, innovative learning techniques. I can certainly think of one of my teachers who was really incredible and had very original methods, who was under total criticism from parents because she didn't give out straight A's automatically to any student that put in an effort. And, you know, under tenure, teachers that try new things, that don't automatically give out A's like candy, they're protected. They have some protection, they have some job security. And that keeps the best teachers in the system. There might be some bad teachers that slip through the cracks and get tenure, but it also benefits the best teachers.
Also, it seems to me if they're legitimately bad, they're probably going to find some way to fire them for cause. If they're flat out just horrendous, eventually they're not doing their job, so they could be fired. It seems to me more likely that the reason that these quote-unquote bad teachers get kept around is a lack of alternatives, that they don't have anyone better to hire because there's not the incentive structure and compensation structure in place to encourage and attract more good quality talent to come to these more at-risk districts.
Yeah, I think that's very true.
Sarah, did you have any thoughts on what Persephone had raised?
I just really agree with her thoughts and conclusions. Really, the issue is that teachers need support through good administration, for one, which is hard to find, and through proper funding, making sure their classrooms have up-to-date materials. One of my favorite anecdotes is that when I took Spanish in freshman year of high school, I saw a textbook with my brother's name in the front, and my brother was 10 grades ahead of me. So this book had to be at least 10 years old, if not older. And I know language doesn't change, but methods of teaching languages change for sure. And so this was a pretty out-of-date book. And it just goes to show that, you know, if it happened in the Spanish classroom, it probably happened in other classrooms. And so it's hard to do the job of teaching when materials aren't there and teachers have to pay out of pocket for supplies. That's a common thing. And they're barely making a living wage. So we're just under providing for our teachers and for our schools. And the outcomes aren't surprising.
Yeah, to your point, I think I've said this before, and I'm going to keep saying it again, and I know Persephone's coming from a similar perspective since we're both Massachusetts people, but there's this bizarre reform idea that's really taking currency, and it was sort of the apex version of it was probably No Child Left Behind, but it's a more general problem, which is this idea that the solution to educational problems is to take away resources as punishment until people shape up. The idea, oh, it's you know, you didn't meet your targets, we're going to defund your district. You know, you didn't have good teachers, we're going to cut your teacher pay and benefits even more. I mean, I kind of understand the impulse there in that it's like, well, why are we dumping money? You know, it's good, you know, don't want to put good money after bad or whatever. But that's not really how it works. I'm sure that there is a point somewhere where you could reach a point where putting in more money wouldn't help. And it's certainly true that in some more well-resourced districts, there's probably a diminishing return in terms of, well, okay, if I put more money in here, is it going to actually benefit the students, or is it just going to buy more fluffy things that they don't actually need? But I mean, even in an affluent district with high educational performance like Persephone and I went to, still the problem is that teachers are still having to buy their own supplies, as was a topic that already came up just a moment ago. And, you know, there's all these having to have private fundraisers for various things on top of the school budget. And, for example, while we were in high school, they eliminated the substitute teacher program completely, and that has not come back. There are still no substitute teachers at the high school that Persephone and I went to. And again, you know, you can question, oh, well, how much were they going to get? You know, how much benefit were they going to get? But there's a whole range of other things outside of the classroom that are going to happen and have happened as a result of people not having substitute teachers. You know, maybe they'll get some of the kids, like the younger ones, go to like a lecture hall thing and just sit there like it's a study hall. Right. And maybe if they're lucky and really focused and determined, they'll get some studying done. But generally, they probably aren't going to get a whole lot done. And then the rest of the kids have free periods where all kinds of shenanigans that are counterproductive to learning are happening. Even just having them, you know, sit in the classroom with the substitute teacher and maybe, you know, who knows, give the sub something to, you know, some materials to pass out, have them work on it or something. Even that is probably better. And that doesn't even get into the whole, like, not being able to hire enough people or the classroom sizes and things like that. So even in the most well-resourced districts, there's still room for if you come up with the money, for things that you can do with that money that will be productive uses of the money that will get better educational outcomes. But then you go to the opposite end of the spectrum, the more under-resourced districts, and you still get this bizarre idea that, oh, well, this isn't working currently, so let's take away money as punishment. That is so crazy, because now you're depriving those districts that already didn't have enough money, you're taking away even more of their money. You know, people reject this idea that I've said many times, which is, yeah, education's one of those things where you can put in more money and you see a result. I think there's some thought that, oh, well, if they give more money to these districts, it's just going to be burned up and we're not going to see any educational outcomes. Well, yeah, because they're probably so severely under-resourced that the amount of new money is going to be a drop in the bucket. If you deluged these districts with money, it wouldn't be wasted. It would actually be used, or at least a very significant percentage of it would be used to generate improved outcomes. Because if you put in a ton of more money into these districts, you will get better educational outcomes. Pretty much the entire New England states region has managed to prove this to be the case going back to, you know, colonial times. Yeah, there are high property taxes in most of those states, especially as a percentage of income. That money then goes into the school districts and they get good educational results. In contrast, you look at areas like the Deep South, not to pick on them, but they're opening $1 million football stadiums and stuff for these high schools instead of putting the money into educational outcomes. And then they get the unsurprising result that they have some of the worst educational scores in the nation. It's a very clear correlation. More money in, better results. Then this leads to the problem of, okay, well, some areas have more resources and higher tax bases to put into these things. And you know, a great example, I mean, it's true in Massachusetts too, but a great example is how most of Detroit's problems, educational or otherwise, come from the entire tax base having left the city to go to all the suburbs right around the city and then saying, no, this is our money and the city doesn't get any of it because we live outside the city. Other places around the world have solved this problem by creating metropolitan districts where they basically pool all the resources and administration for a huge metropolitan area and say, you don't get to keep all the money in your little regional pocket there around the city. Because, I mean, it's similar to the concept of taxing the wealthy to pay for resources that will benefit everyone simply because the poor people can't sustain it. And people don't like that idea in the United States. So it's not really any surprise that you then add on the localism drive in the US and you get the result where people don't want to spend any of their tax money outside of their own immediate district. But, you know, if you want a city like Detroit or even Boston to have good educational outcomes, you're going to have to get the money from somewhere. So it's either going to have to come from the suburban communities around it, or it's going to have to come from the federal government or the state government if the state can figure out how to get the resources. But we've shown that if you come up with the resources and figure out how to distribute the resources and distribute the tax burden to pay for that, that you get good educational outcomes. That's the solution. In probably 90% of these alleged problems, the solution is not let's cut resources from the districts, let's cut resources for the teachers, let's under-resource everything, let's break the unions. That's not the solution. The solution, 9 times out of 10, if not more, is going to be, yes, dump more money into the district. It will help.
And you know, Bill, what I don't understand is what do these people think the schools are spending the money on? Do they not realize that we're talking about, in many cases, we're talking about like pencils, like students who don't have pencils, you know, that don't have textbooks, that don't have paper? You know, do they think that these teachers are like stuffing their pockets with like Belgian chocolates and I don't know what else? Like, where do they think this money is going?
It's a good question. Sarah, did you have any closing thoughts?
This is just one facet of a complex issue. I encourage listeners to read up also on school choice, you know, Diane Ravitch versus Michelle Reath. Just read up on all these issues and wonder why it's so easy to pin problems on teachers and antagonize teachers rather than trying to team up with them. And parents, teachers, and students should all be working together. And administration should be more supportive of teachers.
Right. Yeah. I think this is, you touched on a very important facet here, which is that, and I brought this up at the very beginning, which is like this lawsuit in California was not done by, you know, some nonprofit group that was just doing this out of the beneficence of their heart. This was not done by the students' families. This was bankrolled by anti-union groups and anti-union, you know, mega donors who already have a track record of trying to break union power. The same thing with Michelle Ray and these various other quote-unquote innovations. Charter school movement, that's a very problematic one. It's tied to the American segregation movement and brings up a whole range of problems that we could get into in terms of how that's executed, although there's a high variability in how that's done state by state. But all of these things, there's sort of this undercurrent of anti-unionism behind it, saying that the unions are the problems, that the teachers are the problems, or whatever. And even when it's a little bit more removed, there's always, it always kind of seems to circle back to that. And I think that should raise some red flags, although some people just don't like unions sort of instinctively for whatever misguided reasons. So that's not going to persuade them, but hopefully people who are a little bit more on the fence will give it some more thought. All right, Sarah, thank you for joining us to talk about this week.
My pleasure.
And Persephone, you're going to be joining us for the summer, most episodes as a regular co-host again, like last summer, but it was good to get you on this week for this segment.
Yeah, it was fun.
All right, Arsenal for Democracy will be back in just a moment.